This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The problem up to now has been the absence of genocide. 10 months ago, Samini Sengupta of the New York Times wrote that line to open a memorable story on the tragedy afflicting the Congolese city of Bunia. In the year she spent as West Africa correspondent of the New York Times, she's visited besieged cities, crumbling refugee camps, and filed on tragedies both epic and numbing. Last week, she came back to New York to receive the prestigious George Polk Award in the category of foreign reporting. This hour, Samini Sengupta joins us to talk about West Africa and about her job. How do she and her editors decide what's news? How does she cope with difficult and sometimes dangerous situations and the sometimes equally hazardous living conditions? What's happening in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Congo, and Ivory Coast? And how does she make stories about these far-off places relevant for readers back home? Later on in the program, East meets West on the baseball diamond. We'll talk about the influence Japanese players are having on the American pastime. But now, if you have questions about the situation in West Africa or about the work of a foreign correspondent, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Samini Sengupta joins us from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much.
Now, I wonder, you're back here at a time, you came back, for the timing was to pick up the Polk Award, but it's also the time of the 10th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda and the long shadow that's cast. That opening line I quoted from yours was about a story about a war that's been going on for 4 years, or gone on for 4 years in Congo. Something like 3.5 million people died in the course of it. And in a way, it was about the long shadow of Rwanda, was it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Rwanda belatedly, unfortunately, showed us what can happen when the international community fails to intervene properly. That has, as you say, cast a long shadow over our understanding, I think, of conflicts in Africa and in other places. And it's also shaped, in part, our coverage of it, because I think that that is recent enough to remain in our memories and to haunt us very powerfully. One other thing is that the Rwanda conflict began to haunt our discussions about Africa with the notion of genocide. And it very directly impacted on what the United Nations had to do to stanch the violence that was breaking out in eastern Congo, in Bunia, which is on the far northeastern fringe of Congo, where last May a series of gruesome atrocities began to play out before the eyes of a small group of United Nations peacekeepers who did not have the numbers nor the mandate to really do anything about it except tell the world that it was happening before them. And I think the specter of Rwanda, the long shadow of Rwanda, was very, very important in shaping the Security Council's response to it. And they responded by convincing the European Union, convincing France in particular, to send a emergency mission of 1,500 soldiers to, you know, go in there and restore some semblance of security and order in Bunia before a new and strengthened United Nations peacekeeping mission could take over. I should say that now, nearly a year later, UN peacekeeping faces still very important challenges in Congo, as it does in the rest of the continent. And how that plays out, I think, is going to be very important for the future of peacekeeping in general.
And we'll get back to that in a minute. But one of the ironies of your story, of course, was that many people had been killed in atrocities in that exact region for years. It was only the presence of Western observers that made a difference.
That's right. It was both the presence of Western observers and this notion directly imported from our failure to intervene in Rwanda, the Western world, that perhaps there was something that resembled a potential genocide, because there were members of one ethnic militia slaughtering members of another ethnic group. in point of fact, the fighting in northeastern Congo, as in the rest of the Congo, is much more about greed over Congo's fabulous wealth than it is about ancient tribal hatreds, though tribal enmities, ethnic differences are deployed, to be sure, in the conflict. But as we are seeing today in Congo, that is really less the issue than this fight over natural resources, which, frankly, has been the curse of the continent, an incredibly rich place where greedy warlords and leaders of criminal enterprises have been fighting ferociously at grave human cost.
Greed has not been restricted to them. There have been outsiders involved as well.
Certainly in Congo, there have been outsiders involved. The story of Congo and the reason why it is called Africa's First World War is precisely because so many of its neighbors, Rwanda, Uganda, Zimbabwe, have all gotten involved in both fighting over the spoils of the country and for their own for the defense of their own national security. So this is precisely why the end of war in Congo, in the heart of Africa, I mean, this is Central Africa, a country that is vast, the size of Western Europe, and shares borders with 9 other countries. This is precisely why this is such a crucial time for Congo, because if there can be a lasting peace in Congo, there can potentially be a new era of stability for the entire region.
Well, indeed, not only a shaky peace in Congo, but in Liberia and the Ivory Coast as well. Are they facing similar crossing points at this juncture?
Yeah, I think there are 3 parts of Africa where peace and the prospect of a lasting, stable peace is the issue this year. Congo and Central Africa, the entire region of West Africa, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, those conflicts in that region cannot really be thought of as a succession of civil wars. Those are regional conflicts in nature. Those borders are incredibly porous. And so men and arms pour across those borders very, very freely. Now, the third place, by the way, is Sudan, Africa's largest country, the longest running war on the continent. In all 3 of those areas, there is the prospect, a very real prospect, of peace, but bedeviled by conflict still. For example, in Ivory Coast, I think many of your listeners will know that in the last couple of weeks, Ivory Coast has devolved into new trouble, and UN peacekeepers have deployed there. And I think there are some real questions about whether and how quickly the warring parties there will agree to play ball with each other.
And even if one takes the most optimistic view that things are going to work out, things are going to stabilize and return to normal, there are going to be ongoing problems. The stories that you've written about the child soldiers who've populated these armies that so often have been moving across this entire region, these some of them now young men, will have to be reintegrated into society. This will not be easy.
No, that's a huge challenge. In fact, peace in Africa, just as peace in any other part of the world, is not about signing a peace deal. There are, in my mind, at least 3 major challenges that face Africa this year, face African leaders and African civil society and the outside world. The first is what to do about the arms flow. There are a whole lot of guns in these countries. The second is to restore a semblance of government, things like getting schools working, getting hospitals working, getting young people in a classroom rather than, you know, standing at a checkpoint with a Kalashnikov trying to extort money from everybody who passes down the road. So restoring a sense of government and restoring basic government functions. Connected to that is restoring a government that can use the resources of their respective countries for the benefit of their people rather than to fatten their leaders' pockets. And the third, I think, extremely important challenge is how to deal with human rights on the continent. There has been a legacy of impunity in many of these countries. There's a real challenge facing their citizens and their leaders about how to deal with this legacy of atrocities. So there's a debate going on the continent about, you know, to what extent justice must be balanced with stability. So if you drag old warlords into a court of law to face justice, how much do you upset a delicate peace? On the other hand, if you don't compel perpetrators or those really responsible for these human rights violations, can you really achieve a lasting peace? And what are the mechanisms? What are the justice mechanisms that will be used to really bring about a lasting peace? So in my mind, those are the three things that are going to be debated for the rest of this year. And potentially there will be lessons for the future, not just for African nations, but beyond.
Our guest is Somini Sengupta, the West Africa correspondent for The New York Times. She's at our bureau in New York. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN@npr.org. Now let's begin with a caller from Sacramento, California. Steve joins us. Welcome.
Yes, Neil, thank you. Thank you very much. My question to our wonderful journalists who have served and taken time to be in Liberia or Africa as a whole. We have a situation in Liberia now that the disarmament is being slowed. Would you share with the American public how will it be better for us to let our officials know here, those of us who can't go to Liberia because of the situation there, to have the disarmament started because the people brought some guns and the people who were responsible for disarmament, which is the United Nations, as others say, they're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what will we do?
Disarmament is a huge challenge for Liberia, just as it is a huge challenge for any of these countries that are coming out of conflict. I mean, I think the United Nations faces a really tough battle. You can't do disarmament nor reintegration of gunmen overnight. You've got to have a system in place. You've got to convince each of the warring factions that this is in their interest. You've got to convince communities that, you know, they need to take back or they're going to have to take back men and on occasion women who have committed grave atrocities against their own people. So this is an enormous, enormous social challenge. And to get young men who have very little skills, who have virtually no education, who have really been able to feed themselves by the power of the gun for many, many years. In Liberia, this has been going on for 14 years. We're talking about at least one generation. So, this is an enormous challenge, but I think as ordinary people in Liberia will tell you, and I think as the callers, friends, and family members in Liberia know better than anyone, until the place is disarmed and until the gunmen have another path, there's going to be nothing resembling peace.
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
Oh, good, Neil. Thanks.
Bye-bye. In just a few seconds, is it common now for most men to carry weapons in Liberia?
Oh, I don't know if it's common for most men, but certainly there are an awful lot of men. If memory serves correctly, there are an estimated 50,000 ex-combatants, as they're called in UN lingo, in Liberia. Something like 15,000 of them are children under 18. That's an astonishing figure.
And nobody took their AK-47s when they demobilized?
The demobilization has just begun, and disarmament is just about to get underway again.
More with Somini Sengupta of The New York Times when we come back from a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with reporter Samini Sengupta. Last January, she left her position on the New York Times Metro desk to take up the paper's West Africa coverage. Since then, she's written about some of the world's most brutal, underreported conflicts. Her work just won a prestigious George Polk Award for excellence in foreign reporting, and she joins us this afternoon from our bureau in New York. Of course, you're invited to join us if you have questions about the news from West Africa over the past year. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN, at npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Michael, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Yes, hello, Neil.
Hi.
I was hearing your guest talk about the prevalence of arms and how easily they're available in the Congo, and you read about this in other areas of the world where these conflicts are going on, and I want to know what is being done or can be done about the people who are supplying these arms. Are they, and do they have a good idea of who is supplying them predominantly? They're coming from U.S. manufacturers, from overseas, Russian. Where are they coming from, and what can be done to halt the supply of arms and weapons to manage these conflicts?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The weapons come really from everywhere, and some of them are really old. I think in Congo, there was an estimate that I heard that the weapons that the ex-combatants in Congo still have in their possession, half of them sort of work, and the other half are so old that they barely function. There has been discussion in Congo, for example, there's been discussion of UN peacekeepers on the ground taking it upon themselves to monitor the borders from where the supply of weapons is believed to be coming from. There is always the possibility
of sanctions.
That's
an awfully big border.
There are many borders. There are many, many borders. But, you know, the war in northeastern Congo, in Ituri, in the region called Ituri, that's where the war has not ended. There's no peace there. There are still guns coming through there. There's still military training going on there. So the focus would not be on all of Congo. It would be in that region. Mm-hmm. And there has always been talk of sanctions against countries that continue to supply arms.
Michael, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Bernie. And Bernie's on the line with us from Oakland, California.
Hi, Somini. I have to commend you on your reporting and the well-deserved award, and I have one question. Given the sketchy relationship between Indians and Africans in Africa, how have you been received as an Indian American?
Oh, that's a fabulous question. You know, it's in some places I'm just not recognized necessarily as an Indian, because, you know, it might be in parts of Africa, remote parts, where they just haven't seen me. And there have been occasions when I've been called white man, which is a little alarming to me, but be that as it may. But in other places, because of the vast popularity of Indian movies, believe it or not, people kind of immediately, you know, especially people in cities, people of a certain generation who remember going to see Indian movies in the 70s and 80s, they're sort of delighted to talk to me about the old movie stars.
So hooray for Bollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
Bernie, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Kurt. And Kurt's on the line with us from Cape Town in South Africa.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. I was wondering if your guest could help put some context on some of these stories. Sometimes it seems like these discussions about difficulties in West Africa and elsewhere seem to come out of a bit of a vacuum. And I'm wondering about the legacy of colonialism and also Cold War manipulation and the extent to which he still sees these connections and whether they're acknowledged and whether there's a role that the former colonial powers or the Cold War powers are playing in helping address the problems that she sees.
Yeah, first on the experience of colonialism, I mean, you certainly see in a place like West Africa, for example, where these national boundaries were drawn up by Europeans sitting in a room somewhere who just carved up societies that had their own logic, that had their own governments, that had their own languages, and carved them up willy-nilly for the advantage of the colonial power. So, for example, the border between Liberia and Ivory Coast, it's a very long border. And people who speak the same language, who belong to the same ethnic group, who are members of the same families, live on both sides of the border, which is one of the things that makes it very easy for a warring faction in one country to recruit their kinsmen and women from the other country, if you will. Now, no one right now, as far as I'm aware, is having any active discussions about redrawing those borders.
Yeah, in the days of the old Organization of African Unity, the old thought was the only thing that's worse than the borders we have now is changing them.
I think, you know, the AU, the African Union, is certainly not having any active discussions about changing those borders. But I think there's a growing realization that you have to treat these conflicts and these countries as regional conflicts in nature, where old relationships, old enmities, old alliances really matter. If you'll remember, in Liberia, Charles Taylor was accused of helping some bad boys in Western Ivory Coast who were seeking to oust the Ivorian president, Laurent Gbagbo. And in the meantime, Laurent Gbagbo's people were accused of helping a rebel group called Modell in southeastern Liberia along the border with Ivory Coast, providing them with training and guns and so on. So these are wars of, revenge, vindication, different players using these extremely porous borders and the guns that flow freely across them to their own advantages. The question about the Cold War politics, I think, is also a very, very interesting one. For a long time, both the Soviet Union and the United States, as we well know, turned a blind eye to repressive dictatorships in many of these countries. By Mobutu's final years in Congo, this is Mobutu Sese Seko, the ex-ruler of what was then called Zaire, by his last years, it became very difficult for Washington to really support him in the way they used to, let's just say. But for an awfully long time, both of the world powers used their friends on the continent in the way that it suited them. When the Cold War ended, many of these countries were dropped. They were no longer necessary. That had its own logic. So you had, dictators like Mobutu, who then faced a formidable enemy in a man called Laurent Kabila, who came in with his own army, and whereupon began Congo's latest war. So I think the legacy, as your listener points out correctly, of both the colonial experience and the Cold War manipulation of Africa has had disastrous repercussions in many instances across the continent. And now I think There's an additional issue, and that is how is the West, namely the United States, going to treat Africa? In the post-Cold War years, there's a new element in all of this, and that is oil on the Atlantic coast, on the West African coast. And what is our government willing to do and not willing to do to see that this oil development, this oil money, is actually going to once and for all be somewhat of a blessing instead of a curse for Africa? I mean, I think that's one of the crucial questions facing both the leaders of these African oil-rich African countries, but also the consumers, the largest consumers of oil.
But following up on Kurt's question, given the legacy of colonialism and the Cold War, the disastrous wars that have continued through the region, especially the last few years, is there hope for these countries? I mean, are we always going to be having these kinds of conflicts?
Yeah, I hesitate to render a judgment on whether there is or is not hope for Africa. I mean, I think one of the things that I struggle with as a journalist, as an American journalist, is, you know, trying to figure out why is Africa important. I think the short answer is paying attention to Africa is important because people live there. People who, believe it or not, are much like us, people who worry about their children, who worry about putting food on the table, who worry about their safety and their health, the vast majority of ordinary people who aren't running around with Kalashnikovs. But to sort of carry that a little further, I think it's more important now than ever before to pay attention to how the world's other half lives and dies, how the world's other half tries to get over these horrific conflicts. And there are lessons for us here.
Kurt, thanks very much.
Thanks for taking my call.
Bye-bye. Let's go to, I hit the wrong button, and we're going to go to Chris, and Chris is on the line with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. First, I just wanted to say thanks to Ms. Sengupta for her work, and thanks to you, Neil, for your kind of continuing to return to African issues, because I just think that's so important. I have a PhD in African history from Yale, and one of the things that goes on in academia is a certain amount of a debate over journalism in about Africa, where, you know, country specialists get upset at you know, lack of details or incorrect details, and also a certain feeling that American journalism tends to reproduce stereotypes about Africa. But on the other hand, you know, one knows that journalists, you know, you've got this huge area you're covering. It's a fantastic amount to have to try and absorb and convey, and then you're addressing an audience. And I guess that's my question is, how do you think of your audience? How much do you think they know? How much do you feel like you have to provide context or assume certain kinds of stereotypes just to hook into what people already think in order to get current information across?
Yeah, I think that, I think of my audience as me. I was entirely ignorant of the issues in this part of the world when I started my beat, and my learning curve was extremely steep and is still steep. I know really very little about how many of these societies work. So I do think it's important for me to explain to readers who may not be specialists on Africa. And again, I should say, Africa is a vast continent, so one might be a specialist in Southern Africa and know absolutely nothing about Chad and Cameroon, for instance. So, you know, my job is to explain to my readers something about the context of these countries and also explain to them why this is important. And I guess I keep coming back to this. The reason it's important is because people live there. And I think it's increasingly important for us as Americans to finally wake up to the realization that, you know, the world knows a lot more about us than we know about them. And at some point, that's, you know, got to be addressed. And I think that's what, you know, that's part of my job as a newspaper journalist. As for stereotypes, I do hope, and I try very hard not to perpetuate stereotypes. Do I succeed all the time? Probably not. You know, I also have thought long and hard about whether all that conflict reporting that I did last year was necessarily the best choice, you know, because there are lots and lots of places in Africa where there's no conflict, where people are just living.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And, you know, I could have chosen to write a feature about leather workers in Mali rather than cover the conflict in Liberia last June and July and August. I decided that would not be the fair thing to do. There was an enormously important story breaking out in Liberia. There was enormous suffering there in a country that we as Americans have a very close historical relationship to, and that, you know, it was my job, it was my responsibility and obligation as a West Africa correspondent to tell that story.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, can I just say I'm incredibly impressed by your thoughtfulness about all of this, and it makes me really hopeful, and also just that, you know, on the academic versus journalism, the academics have done a pretty lousy job in getting our knowledge out, so we need to pick up our end of it. But thanks a lot.
Thank you. That's kind.
Let me read the description of the George Polk Award. Soumini Sengupta of the New York Times is the winner of the George Polk Award for Foreign Reporting. Her dispatches from Congo, Liberia, and other war-torn areas in West Africa lent both a political and human dimension to the horrific conflicts in the region that were not widely covered in the American press. She faced many dangerous logistical obstacles, often exposing herself to great personal risk in pursuit of her stories. I wanted to ask you, I've been reading a lot of your clips over the past couple of days, and there was a situation in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia, you were just talking about, where you write that you moved from one side of the war-torn city to the other, said journalists got to see the other side of the conflict by crossing a bridge after waving a white T-shirt. What was that about?
Yeah, that was... I was itching to get to the rebel-held side of the city, which had basically been off-limits to us. The bridge that you just read about was the front line. And I had tried, for the last couple of days to actually get across that bridge. I tried to convince some fishermen to row me over across the water. They've said, no way, are you crazy? So there was a little bit of a lull in fighting, and a handful of journalists, I think there were four or five of us, we decided that we were going to try to walk across by foot. And that's what we did. And I have to say, we were blessed in the sense that in Liberia during the war, neither side, neither the government side nor the rebel side, were hostile towards journalists. So, yeah, we could have been, caught in the crossfire, and shells could have landed and all of that, but they weren't actively targeting us as they have been in other parts of the world.
Are you going back?
Oh, yeah, I fly back on Sunday, and yeah.
And as you look at this, I mean, you came from the Metro desk, as you said, you didn't know anything about Africa when you started. Is this, how do you view it now?
Well, I know a little bit more about how to travel in the region, which is very, very difficult. You know, mm-hmm. It's logistically extremely challenging. I got to say, there is nothing more gratifying to me as a reporter than just to be left alone, to be able to travel and roam and, you know, knock on people's doors and step into their lives and make sense of their stories. I mean, I do really think whether it's in New York or in California or in West Africa or wherever, human beings have a story to tell, and they want to tell a story about their lives. It's a way that we make sense of who we are, and that's a great privilege to be a part of.
Soumini Sengupta, congratulations.
Thank you.
Soumini Sengupta, the New York Times West Africa correspondent, joined us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a break, Japanese ballplayers. It's Talk of the Nation.